dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I'm hosting you about the battle space of the War of Ideas today with Eric Stackelbeck of CBN News' highly regarded Stackelbeck on Terror program. We'll be visiting with Eric about the Muslim Brotherhood here and abroad in segment one. Segment two, we'll be talking with a first responder in Israel who recounts what he found at the site of a horrific terrorist attack in Israel's historic homeland. Segment three, we'll be visiting with Andy McCarthy. Get his take on the Libya caper and what is likely to come next. Also, a very vexing problem, the administration's decision to simply dispense with some of the historic positions the United States government has taken with respect to the Geneva Convention. And finally, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz, our duty expert on the Pentagon, on the implications for our national security more broadly of this seemingly open-ended campaign now underway in Libya, and also what the Russians and the United States are doing about missile defense. You're not going to believe this. First up, Eric Stackelbeck. Welcome back to Secure Freedom, Eric. It's great to have you with us, as always, especially at a time when some of the work you've been doing at CBN on the threat posed by the Muslim Brotherhood could not be more needed, more timely. So let's talk a little bit about that. But first, thanks again for joining us.
Hey, great to be here, Frank. Thanks.
In your programming, Eric Stackelbeck on Terror, you have done a number of very important interviews and special pieces on the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'd like you to talk just a little bit about your insights as it relates not just to the prospects it might well emerge as a very serious player, if not the dominant player in the Middle East as a result of all of this awakening and so on, but also what it's up to here in the United States.
Well, Frank, two things. Number one, we've been saying this all along. We've been warning about the Muslim Brotherhood threat, not only in America, but in Egypt as a result of the revolution there. Well, guess who's now finally catching on? The New York Times. Believe it or not, Frank, yesterday the New York Times ran a piece talking about the rise, the quote, rise of the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Well, surprise, surprise. People like you and I, Frank, were saying from the outset that this was exactly what was going to happen. And now the New York Times is even saying how the Brotherhood is exercising more and more influence in the Egyptian government. Even with this kind of ruling military coalition, it seems like the Brotherhood may even have some de facto kind of agreement with this ruling military regime right now that's overseeing the government in Egypt. So that was one thing that really struck me and had to make me shake my head and laugh, because the left and the likes of the New York Times were gung-ho about this Egyptian revolution at the outset and saying that we don't have to worry about the Muslim Brotherhood. Now all of a sudden they're concerned.
Yeah, but one sort of clue that we might have a problem here was the army allowing Yusuf al-Qaradawi, one of their spiritual godheads, to come in and address 2 million people in Cairo and urge them on to Jerusalem. Go ahead, your second point.
Yeah, and the people in the crowd, Frank, as Qaradawi spoke, were chanting "Martyrs in the millions to Jerusalem." That says it all. In terms of the Brotherhood here on American soil, Frank, I did a story this week about one of the most influential arms of the American Brotherhood, and that's the Muslim Students Association. Now, the MSA is the oldest Brotherhood front group in America and one of the largest. This is a student group that's present on college campuses throughout the U.S. and Canada, hundreds of campuses, even the Ivy League, Frank. So I did an expose on this group. This is a group identified in Brotherhood documents. Not my documents, the Brotherhood's own documents, seized by the FBI as a friend of the Brotherhood. That's who the Muslim Students Association is, Frank. Yet they're the largest Muslim group on American college campuses. Our federal law enforcement is doing nothing about it. And leaders, not just rank and file members of the MSA, but leaders have been arrested and convicted on terrorism charges. I'll give you an example, Frank, of what kind of the mettle of the MSA leadership, the kind of student leaders they're turning out. None other than Anwar al-Awlaki, the al-Qaeda cleric and jihadi superstar, was the president of the MSA's Colorado State University chapter in the mid-1990s, and that's just the tip of the iceberg with this group's terror connections.
Yeah. Well, Eric Stackelbeck is our guest, and the work that you're doing at CBN, Eric, is of incalculable importance. So thanks so much for this special drill down on the Muslim Students Association. I think it actually is full-fledged Muslim Brotherhood, not simply a friend of the Brotherhood. But the one Absolutely. Of the things that I saw this just yesterday, and I'm sure you've seen as well, but I really commend it to our listeners, is a clip on YouTube of one of these MSA leaders leading his audience in some conclave, and I think it was out in California, if I'm not mistaken, in a pledge of
right.
allegiance. Did you happen to see this? It's a pledge of allegiance,
Frank,
basically to the Muslim Brotherhood creed, including
yes.
die in the way of Islam. And it's just chilling
yes.
that's the kind of thing that's being promoted here, as you know.
And they're mainstream on our college campuses, Frank.
Right, right. And hundreds and hundreds of chapters. Speaking of trying to block this kind of activity, I wanted to touch with you quickly in the remaining time we have with you, Eric, on two things. One, there is a hearing next week led by Dick Durbin, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, in the Senate Judiciary Committee that looks as though it's just a setup to promote the Muslim Brotherhood line that Muslims are being horribly victimized in America. I'd like to get your thoughts on the actual facts of that story and what you might expect to come out of that hearing.
Well, Frank, this is a complete charade. Look at the statistics. Look at the FBI hate crime statistics. Who is the most persecuted minority group overwhelmingly year after year after year? Jews. Why not a hearing on anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish violence in America? It's a much greater threat. Quote-unquote anti-Muslim violence in this country is minuscule. Minuscule. Every statistic from the Department of Justice on to the FBI shows that. This is political posturing by Durbin. I'm sure he has a large Muslim constituency back in Illinois. It's posturing. It's shameful, quite frankly. It's shameful.
Well, it's worse than shameful, I think, Eric, in the sense that my guess is that one of the themes that will be sounded there by U.S. government officials who will be testifying as well as other witnesses is that Islamophobia, as they like to call it, is a greater threat to the United States than is terrorism. Now, this sounds incredible, I'm sure, to most of us, but this is nonetheless the emerging line as a vehicle to try to suppress, well, among other things, the kind of work that you're doing and the kind of conversation we're having right now. It's all, Sharia blasphemy. Eric, speaking of the FBI, very quickly, we've got about a minute and a half. Tell us about the tenure of Bob Mueller as the FBI director, which is now coming to an end, and what you're hearing about who may replace him.
John, I spoke to a former FBI special agent about Mueller last week who told me, he said, I think at the end of the day, Mueller's a good man, but he just doesn't get it. He doesn't get it when it comes to this jihadist threat, and the bureaucracy has just stifled him and changed him in a lot of ways. The people we're hearing about, possible successors, Jamie Gorelick is one name, Frank, Clinton administration bureaucrat. She was responsible for the infamous wall that went up between the FBI and the CIA, where our two leading intelligence agencies could not share information about Islamic terrorist plots, anything. They literally could not share information because of this wall that was set up by none other than Jamie Gorelick, who the Obama administration is apparently considering as the next leader of the FBI.
And this contributed, this wall, as you know, Eric, contributed to, we're told, the 9/11 report.
Yes, it did.
Attacks, though the commission on which she served seemed to have obscured that fact. We're also hearing about Janet Napolitano, and there will be others coming to light here, I'm sure. A 10-year tenure is at stake. It is very important that we not get someone who's been a part of the problem in this post. We want somebody who's actually going to help defend us, and perhaps better than Bob Mueller has. Eric, we're going to have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for joining us and for the absolutely splendid work you do with Steckelbeck on Terror at CBN. Please come back to us again soon. There's always something going on that we need your insights on. Next up, Staff Sergeant Eddie Eidelman of the Israel Defense Forces on the murder of the Fogels and what it might just mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any other junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. Now, I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Michael Medved is asking Congress to simplify the corporate tax code for good reason.
This is a real problem. Of the 500 top Fortune companies, nearly 100 pay no taxes because they use various dodges
that have been written into the law by lobbyists.
And the President of the United States and Paul Ryan, the House Budget Chair,
and John Boehner, the Speaker of the House,
everybody ought to work together to get rid of this stuff.
It's just wrong.
The Michael Medved Show, afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Ideas that can set America free. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Now, more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I recorded earlier a conversation with Staff Sergeant Eddie Eidelman of the Israel Defense Forces, a man who is a paramedic serving his country in the West Bank, the area to the west of the Jordan River, also known as Judea and Samaria, to those familiar with the history of the region. Staff Sergeant Eidelman was the first responder in a horrific incident that took the lives of 5 Israeli civilians, a mother, a father, and 3 children, in the Israeli community known as Itamar. And we spoke with him with the assistance of a a government minder, who you will hear from at one point, about his experiences, about the circumstances under which this attack took place, and a little bit, at least, an insight, at least, into what this particular tragedy and act of barbaric cruelty, of savagery, means for all of us who love freedom. We are joined by Staff Sergeant Eddie Eitelman of the Israel Defense Forces, a man who had the unhappy responsibility of being the first to respond to a horrific attack upon a family known as the Fogels in a community on the West Bank, also known as Judea and Samaria. And we've asked Staff Sergeant Eitelman to join us to talk a little bit about not only this particular episode, but also what it suggests about the peril that the people of Israel face day in and day out. And I hope he'll help us understand why that peril perhaps is also headed our way if we're not careful. So Staff Sergeant Eitelman, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your service to what I think of as the free world there in Israel. And tell us a bit about the West Bank, the circumstances of this attack, and then let's get into a bit of the unhappy details.
Let me start by telling you a little bit about the West Bank. The West Bank is a region in Israel which is populated both by Israeli citizens and Palestinian citizens. Okay? They live one next to each other in small Israeli communities and Palestinian villages, and there really is a big mix of the population in this area.
So, in other words, there's no apartheid in the West Bank.
No. There is a mix of the population, and this poses some problems for us as the Israeli Defense Forces because of the reasons that some of the Palestinians, I mean, I bet most of them, are good people, loving people, and, you know, just simple human beings. But there is a certain, from the West Bank, mostly in the past and still nowadays, operates terrorist cells, and they try to execute terrorist attack against Israeli citizens. And so this is why the IDF is there, to guard the Israeli citizens.
Staff Sergeant Eitelman, let me ask you this. There are, of course, known to us in the United States, terrorists associated with Hamas that predominantly have been operating from, of course, the Gaza Strip. Is it your understanding that it was Hamas operatives that were responsible for these crimes in which five members of the Fogel family were brutally murdered, or were there others believed to be responsible for this act?
I'll have to be truthful with you. I'm really sorry, but I cannot disclose this information.
Okay.
Because this is still an ongoing investigation. I can tell you about the two major terrorist organizations in the area. One of them is the Hamas, and the other is the Islamic Jihad.
Okay.
And this is all I can tell you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
He won't be able to respond to that.
I understand.
It's still under investigation.
I understand. We are mindful that there are other groups that have also been associated with terrorist attacks involved with other organizations than the ones you've mentioned, and we'll be waiting with very keen interest to discover whether those are some of them. The parties responsible here, or whether it's just the ones that one or the other of the ones you've mentioned, sorry, Staff Sergeant. Give us again, if you would, then what you found when you were called to respond to the attack on the Fogel family.
So first, let me explain what I was doing there in the first place.
Yeah,
I serve as a paramedic on the military mobile intensive care units. There are ambulances staffed with emergency equipment, and we respond to calls in the whole area of the West Bank. Okay?
Yep.
My unit sits sits approximately 10 minutes from Itamar. And Friday night, the night between Friday and Saturday, approximately 1 a.m., I get a phone call that says that there has been a terrorist penetration in Itamar and I should go there. And I take the crew, is a driver and the medic, and I take them both, and we get into the car and we start driving there. And we go inside the settlement of Itamar, and it's still unclear, is the terrorist still in the house? Is he somewhere in the settlement? It's all very foggy at first, okay? And we reach the house, and still not sure what's happening in the house. Is anyone in there? Is the terrorist in there? Are they held as hostages? We're not quite sure. And so we enter the house, and we realize there is no terrorist in there, but we start discovering the injured. And the first room I entered, I saw a three-year-old child lying on a carpet with three stab wounds in his chest. I'm sorry if the information I'm giving is too graphic. Tell me, I'll cut it down a bit.
Well, I think this is what we have a need to know.
Okay.
So go ahead.
So three stab wounds in the chest, and I drop my medic next to him, and I tell him, start giving rescue breaths. Let's see what we can do with him. And I continue doing the triage. The triage is going through every room in the house and realizing, is there someone wounded there? In what priority is he? And so the next room I enter, I see a 12-year-old child lying on the bed. Butchered will be the best way to describe it. His throat was slit very, very brutally. And I see him and I realize he is dead and there is nothing we can do for him. I enter the third room. In the entrance, I see a woman lying in a pool of her own blood with multiple stab wounds. She, again, is dead. I check for pulse, I check for breathing, but there is nothing I can do for her. And in the same room, on the bed, I see the father, a man, an adult man, with stab wounds, and he is also dead. Now, approximately behind the father, like kind of behind him, I see something that kind of looks like a blanket, but really doesn't, something that disturbs the eye. And so I want to see what is it, and I flip it over, and I see it as a baby, approximately 3-4 months old. And she is also dead with one stab wound to her skull.
Staff Sergeant Edelman of the Israeli Defense Forces, recounting a most horrific crime against humanity, against a family, against innocent children, as well as adult civilians, perpetrated by we know not yet quite whom, but certainly by enemies of Israel. And I would argue, Staff Sergeant, though you may not be able to identify them just yet, enemies of freedom, enemies of our country, which shares a commitment to freedom with yours. This is a very painful story to hear, and it must have been just dreadful to experience in those moments as you did.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing this with us, because it helps put to mind what it is we're all up against. And we appreciate your service to your country and, as I say, to the cause of freedom. I wish you the best in all of your efforts, for your safety and for your success, and Israel as well. Thank you, Staff Sergeant Edelman. Next up, we'll be talking with Andy McCarthy about all that he does on keeping America safe from the Muslim Brotherhood and wrong-headed politicians. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined once again by our distinguished lawfare expert, a man whose analyses on so many of these issues affecting the law and national security are sought after and followed with great enthusiasm by not only those of us here at Secure Freedom Radio, but by, I think, the media here and abroad and members of Congress and the public at large. It's a great privilege to have back with us Andy McCarthy, the author of Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad, also a superb columnist at National View Online. And Andy, you have been filing some superb essays dissenting from the view taken by some of your colleagues at National Review on Libya. I don't think they would consider themselves neocons, but they seem to fall into the category that Carolyn Glick was talking about earlier in the program, in which people are sort of inclined to support opponents of tyranny without too closely inspecting who they are and what they have in mind. Tell us a little bit about your take on Libya at the moment, and particularly on these so-called rebels.
Well, I think, Frank, I'm glad that you highlight the term rebels, because I think that really is the nub of it. I've been suggesting that we should begin calling them the Libyan Mujahideen, because I think that would be much more clarifying and much more accurately indicative of what we're tumbling ourselves into here. By every account that I've read that's credible, what are called the rebels are actually groups of mainly Islamists. That is the main thrust of them, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood, a Front for the Liberation of Libya, organizations that have ties, which may be loose, may be something more than that, to Al-Qaeda. And interestingly, there are reports that it was Libya that supplied the greatest number, percentage-wise, by any country, of insurgents who transited Syria in order to join the fighting against the United States in Iraq. There's a disproportionately high number of those fighters who come from the areas that are the hotbeds of what are called the rebel resistance to Gaddafi.
Now being protected by the U.S. Air Forces and other so-called international community members protecting...
Protected and enabled.
Yeah, exactly. Andy, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I did want to get as well as your critique of the basic premise of this effort, your views on the advisability of how this has come about in terms of an operation with mandates, however fleeting, from the Arab League and then from the United Nations, but none from the United States Congress. Tell us what the implications of that might be, both for our sovereignty and for our constitutional processes here.
I think this is a constitutionally invalid operation, Frank. And I say that mindful of the fact that the debates over the Constitution lead to a good deal of dispute about exactly what Congress's power to declare war was meant to encompass. I do think that informed by constitutional principles and over two centuries of our history, we have come up with a number of constitutionally derived principles, one of which is when there is no imminent danger to the United States, when we haven't been attacked and there isn't an imminent prospect of attack, the Constitution requires that the President get authorization from Congress before launching military operations like the one we're seeing in Libya, which really involves starting a war with another country, not to mince words. And I just think whether you agree with that or not as a strict matter of constitutional law, it's certainly a principle of prudent policy. And I would say doubly so under circumstances where we have an administration that seems to think a green light from the United Nations or, my God, from the Arab League is something that is essential or a necessary prerequisite to launching the United States into a war where we haven't even heard from the representatives of the American people who actually have the constitutional authority to declare war and who would be expected to pay for these operations.
Yeah, and pay, perhaps. With the permission slip that John Kerry was properly reviled for saying we needed back in the 2004 campaign comes to mind, doesn't it? Andy, let me switch gears here because we'll run out of time with you before we get anywhere near what I'd like to cover done. Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas, a frequent contributor here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm happy to say, had an interesting exchange last week with Bob Mueller, the now outgoing director of the FBI. Two questions to you. One, tell us about that exchange and what insights it gives us about the problem that you've written so beautifully about in the Grand Jihad, among other places, namely the relationship between U.S. government agencies and front organizations of the Muslim Brotherhood, in this case the Council on American Islamic Relations, and also any speculation you might have as to who will be Bob Mueller's successor as the FBI director.
Well, Frank, I can answer the second one first. I have no idea who the Obama administration would pick, and I'm quite fearful because even though a number of us have had our differences with Director Mueller, I think he is certainly superior to whatever is likely to follow him from this administration. I think what Congressman Gohmert was getting at with Bob was this situation where the government, and particularly the FBI, has information and had information for a very long time that the Council on American Islamic Relations has very intimate ties to Hamas and the Hamas support network of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. And it's all well and good for the FBI finally, in around 2008, to say that it was cutting off at least official ties with CARE. Why it ever had official ties, God only knows. But what Gohmert's point was, and I think this is a very good point, is how could we have maintained ties with this awful organization for such a long time when the FBI knew quite well, on the basis of information that was actually ultimately presented in court in the Holy Land Foundation case, that this was a bad organization.
Going back to 1993, for crying out loud. Now, this is really scandalous. We'll be hopefully visiting with Louis Gohmert about this directly, but I appreciate your take on it. Andy, in very short order, could I ask you to turn to one other subject with us, namely a decision taken, again, without seemingly very much regard for either sovereignty or constitutional prerogatives of the Congress, to reinterpret, as I gather they're saying, an important provision of the Geneva Conventions. Can you, in 2 minutes or so, give us what's going on there and what the implications might be?
Yeah, Frank. Because it was well known that the Geneva Conventions did not protect terrorists, there was a movement in 1977 to enact protocols to the Geneva Conventions that would basically endow terrorists and what were known then as sort of national freedom fighters with more rights. The United States wisely, and this is administrations of both parties, declined to seek the ratification of that treaty precisely because it empowered terrorists. The Obama administration has changed course, and I think even more offensively, frankly, has said that, and this is the words of Secretary of State Clinton, that they're doing this out of what she calls a sense of legal obligation. That's really code for saying that they are interpreting what they call customary international law to trump the Constitution's treaty ratification requirements. They are just going to basically deem this treaty ratified rather than actually go through the process, and I think that's not only a dangerous development, but a really, frankly, offensive one.
Yeah. In other words, that they are essentially saying that a treaty that the United States specifically, in this case a protocol, specifically did not accept, will nonetheless now be part of the law we will be conforming to without having gone through, as you say, the appropriate constitutionally mandated treaty-making process, let alone any proper consultations or debate. Andy, troubling stuff, Lawfare all about us. Thank you for monitoring it. Thank you for sharing it with us, and we'll talk to you again next week. Next up, we will be talking with Bill Gertz about the view from inside the ring on all of this. It's not pretty. We all need to be paying attention to it. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Sanger.
I had a feeling about this. I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas.
Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is there an epidemic in Washington? Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Bill Gertz, our duty expert on the Pentagon operations from inside the ring, a beat that he covers brilliantly for the Washington Times, where he serves as the geopolitics editor as well as the author of a column by that name, Inside the Ring. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's great to have you with us as always.
Hi, good to be on the show.
Bill, a lot is going on at the moment, as you well know, concerning Libya. I'd like to get your sense of, first of all, what the toll has been to date in terms of an overstretched military of taking on this new responsibility. Whether that's likely to be relieved in any appreciable way by this new deal with NATO. And not least, your assessment based on your column of the idea that we can safely do business with this so-called National Transitional Council in Libya. First of all, who they are and then what you make of them.
Sure.
So let's work through the Libya account here.
Sure. I think the one on the plus side, one thing the Libya military operation shows is a very quick turnaround in the U.S. military's ability to conduct an operation. I mean, there was literally a matter of days before they were directed to be ready to launch operations. That said, they didn't have a good strategy behind this tactical operation to set up a no-fly zone. And we're seeing the consequences of that. Divisions, a lack of support from the international community. That said, NATO is taking over. As I've mentioned in the past, NATO just does not have the capability to conduct a war. We learned that back in the 90s with the Balkans when we put the NATO forces in charge, and the end was a massacre in Srebrenica. So that's the first problem. But the cost, you know, there were voices in the Pentagon that were saying, "Whoa, hold on, we're stretched militarily, financially. These operations are extremely expensive. You know, the cost ranges in the hundreds of millions to do these operations." So that's a real consideration.
And that's if it's just a short-term proposition. If it turns out to be longer-term,
right,
and we wind up doing the bulk of the heavy lifting, as you say, because NATO can't, even though it may be under a sort of new management, at least for outward appearances, it's still winding up being our
and,
burden.
And as for the National Transitional Council, there's a lot of question marks. There was a meeting at the White House. Senior State Department officials seem to be throwing U.S. support behind this council, whereas just last week the White House was saying, "We're not sure if this is a group worthy of our support." The problem is there are clear indications that there are Islamists within this group that, although they may be supporting the coalition now to oust Gaddafi, may have alternative objectives that may not be in support of the idea of setting up a pro-Western democracy. I think that's a real threat.
Yeah, in your column, Bill, you mentioned that there was reason to believe that the leadership might be sort of configured, or the optics of its approach may be such that it encourages the belief that they're all committed to democracy, but in fact lurking behind them are Islamists who have a very different agenda indeed, one quite hostile to us. We're talking with Bill Gertz of the Washington Times, our regular featured guest this time of the week. He is addressing with us a number of issues arising from the Pentagon's being thrown into the breach to try to work this Libya problem. Bill, this exacerbates presumably a problem that the Chief of Naval Operations was addressing with some of your colleagues earlier in the week concerning his really, I think it can only be described as rising panic about the budget for shipbuilding, for maintaining the fleet that we need to have in the decades to come. This is an issue that I know you have followed in the past, and I assume it's only getting worse, especially as defense budgets are being cut and operations are remaining at a pretty high tempo, to say nothing of new ones being added in.
Absolutely, and of course, the reason that we need to begin an extensive ship buildup now, it can be summarized in one word: China. The Chinese Navy is making expansive use of its military forces, especially naval forces. They now have more submarines than the U.S. has. Granted, ours are probably much more capable, but, you know, quantity has a quality all of its own, as they say in the military. And the U.S. needs to match that. And without a strong shipbuilding budget, we're not going to be able to do that. With this administration being so anti-military buildup, I see this as a huge problem for not just the Navy, but for all the services. You know, the Defense Secretary has launched a what he calls an efficiency initiative, but anybody in the Pentagon will tell you that that's just a cover for a program to slash and burn the defense budget.
Yeah, and it often comes down to that, even if the intentions are otherwise. Bill, I was struck in this report out of Aviation Week from the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead's comments to defense reporters on March 23rd, that he said it will cost a couple of billion dollars to decommission one of our Nimitz-class nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. That's a stunning further indication of how serious the problems are. It costs many billions to build one of these things, but it may cost several billion just to get rid of them, and that's all money that presumably comes out of very limited resources that are supposed to be you know, applied to building the ships that will maintain our capability to have presence and project power around the world. And as you say, I think there's no small contribution made to that rapid turnaround of our military in Libya by our sea-based air and missile assets. And, you know, it's just mind-boggling that we're getting into a sort of death spiral here.
It's outrageous. Yeah, and of course, I would point out, too, that we do not have a aircraft carrier strike group involved in the Libya operation. To me, this is unbelievable. I mean, we do have a big deck amphibious carrier, but it's not the same as bringing to the battle the kind of power and projection capability that an aircraft carrier has with all of its jets and other resources. I was really surprised that the administration chose not to do that, but there were a lot of firsts in this operation, namely that it was the first time in my memory that a president has gone to war without going on television and telling the American public.
Yeah. Yeah, it is sort of striking. This whole thing seems to have been done in a way that that raises serious questions as to whether this is being competently managed. And we're going to be talking more about that with you, Bill, I know, in the days ahead. But, Bill Gertz, before we run out of time, let me ask you quickly about an item that you featured in your Inside the Ring column concerning the U.S. effort to secure a new deal with the Russians on missile defenses at very considerable expense. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a potentially very damaging to our national security. An agreement is being worked on, largely in secret, by the Obama administration to conclude a technology transfer agreement with the Russians. The strategy behind it is that this will somehow get the Russians to go along with our phased adaptive approach of missile defenses in Europe. But according to officials close to the Russians who have had discussions with the Russians, they've switched course now. They're going for engagement. They're going to use this agreement to gain access to our most valuable missile defense technology, this hit-to-kill technology. It's a non-explosive, ultra-high-speed warheads that are used in both our strategic and short-range missile defenses.
Yeah, really troubling on every score. And the extent to which the Russians can completely reverse field on all of this without blinking an eye, let alone being held accountable for it, opposing missile defenses adamantly in the context of the New START treaty for which they were paid, and then turning around and now supporting them in order to get access to our technology is really troubling. Bill Gertz, thank you as always for these terrific insights into the challenges we're facing and the need to maintain both our vigilance and our security. And we'll visit with you again next week. And we'll talk with all of you again next week as well. Same time, same station. Until then, I hope you'll be tuning into us for all that you need to know to secure your freedom and that of those you love. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.